Can a church that's had a history of being toxic transform its culture and become truly healthy? Or are churches like this doomed to repeat their history despite efforts to change? Welcome to The Roys Report, a podcast dedicated to reporting the truth and restoring the church. I'm Julie Roys. And on this podcast, you're going to hear a talk from our last Restore conference by Laura Berenger. Laura and her father, theologian Scott McKnight, co-authored two best-selling books on the church. The first book, A Church Called Tove, talked about creating church cultures that are truly Tove, the Hebrew word for good. Lauren Scott's second book is called Pivot, and it deals with transformation, with turning oppressive church cultures into Tove or good ones. With more and more churches and ministries being exposed as abusive and corrupt, this topic has become extremely relevant. So often, the leader of an organization is exposed as an abuser and removed. And though many within the organization may want to change it, they often find doing so is much harder than they imagined. They've been in the toxic organization so long, they don't know what healthy looks like, what it feels like. In fact, their knee-jerk reaction is almost always to do the wrong thing, not the right thing. So should these organizations just burn to the ground? Or is there a recipe for change? Well, as you'll hear in Laura's talk, change is possible, but it is definitely the road less traveled, and it is incredibly hard. And it can happen only if leaders are committed to changing the culture, which means dealing with the invisible contaminants like greed, ambition, and abuse of power. So this is an incredibly timely and important topic, and one I'm so eager to share with you. But first, I have a very exciting announcement to make. We have set the date for our next Restore conference. Restore 2025 will be held February 7th and 8th in Phoenix, Arizona. We're still booking speakers, but already I can announce that joining us will be author and survivor advocate Mary DeMuth, theologian and author of A Church Called Tove, Scott McKnight, and Baylor University professor and expert on adult clergy sexual abuse, David Pooler. Of course, I will be there as well and will be serving as the MC of the conference. But truly, I think the greatest reason to come to Restore is the amazing community that will gather there of people like yourself. I know many of you have experienced church hurt, and this is an amazing, safe gathering of like-minded people where healing and growth can occur. Registration for the conference will open May 1st, but there will be an exclusive special offer we'll make available in April only to those who sign up for updates. To do that, go to restore2025.com now and sign up for updates. Again, that's restore2025.com and then scroll down to where it says sign up for updates and enter your information there. Well, again, the talk you're about to hear is from our last Restore conference by Laura Berenger, co-author of A Church Called Tove and Pivot. But as you'll hear, she's also a kindergarten teacher and became an author somewhat by accident. Here's Laura Berenger.
Well, I am not a pastor. I am not a preacher. I'm not a church leader like some of you may be here today. And for those of you who attended Restore last year, like Julie mentioned, my father, Scott McKnight, was here and spoke. You may have heard him. I am definitely not a professor and theologian like he is. In fact, I will tell you what I would normally be doing at 11:19 a.m. on a Friday morning at this exact moment, and I'm thinking of them right now. I'd be walking my kindergartners through the lunch line, probably reminding them to hold their trays with two hands so they don't trip. I am, most recently, including this school year, a kindergarten teacher, and my students are about the same height as the chairs you guys are sitting in right now, which means this is not what I normally do. I'm not comfortable being up here, but honestly, as I've watched you, you are quite an easier audience than the five-year-olds that I left in the hand with my substitute teacher today. I don't anticipate you'll shout at me, Mrs. Berenger, and you have something green in your teeth, which is a true story, happened recently. So I'm hoping to return to a good behavior report on Monday, and I hope all is going well in the lunch line right now. So you know what I do all day, and now bear with me as I do something uncomfortable for me, which is speak to adults instead of teaching very young children. I'm not accustomed to people actually looking at me while I'm talking and actively listening. But I am here at Restore because I heard such beautiful stories coming out of this conference last year, and because men and women who tell the truth and resist power because they love God, because they love the church, are heroes of my faith. And that is largely for me what this conference is about. Resisting power and telling the truth for the sake of the church. And there are some of you here in the audience today that told the truth and resisted power. And I have seen it. I have seen truth-telling and resisting power, and I know it probably came at great risk to yourself, to your reputation, to your family. I am grateful for you. I believe you, and I have the greatest respect for you. So I am a teacher, yes, and I am also an unexpected accidental author of two books that I wrote with my dad, as Julie mentioned, A Church Called Tove, and our latest book, Pivot, which published just a few weeks ago. And by the way, I would like to publicly say this. I raised concerns with my dad about using the word pivot as our title because it reminds me, and probably many of you, right, of one of my favorite Friends episodes. Some of you who may know my dad and have had the full Scott McKnight experience, he said, nobody's ever heard of that show. They won't know what we're talking about. I was like, trust me, they know. He had never heard of Friends, never watched it. If you are connected with him at all in social media, you'll see that he's progressed a lot. He's now doing reenactments of this famous pivot scene. So I'm going to start today with a bit of a personal story, how a teacher accidentally became an author, and then we'll talk about transforming toxic cultures into Tove ones, which is the topic of Pivot, our new book, so you know where we are headed. Now, because I'm a teacher, I enjoy the luxury of unhurried summer months, and each morning when I'm home during June, July, and August, I usually take my coffee and my Bible and my journal and usually a beagle. We have three of them. And together we head outside and we settle in chairs in our backyard under the trees. And there I read my Bible and I pray. I read aloud the Psalms. And I spend most summer mornings this way just, I'm a theologian's daughter. I get lost in the ancient world. And I do this because I have been taught that I can learn who God is by reading the Bible. And over again, through the pages of the Old Testament and the New Testament, this is what my non-theologically education-trained self has discovered about God, that he cares so very deeply for the isolated, the orphan, the stranger, the betrayed, the vulnerable, the powerless, the suffering, the forgotten, the abused. The Bible is filled with stories about God meeting people who are in distress. And I'll share an example that has come to have very deep meaning for me, an example of God meeting a person in distress in the pages of our Bible. But first, I have to give some context. I learned from my dad and from the Mosaic Law in Deuteronomy that there is a section of verses about witnesses to crimes. And the law says in Deuteronomy 19:15 that one witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Now, as a teacher, the way I would explain this verse to my kindergartners for application is that you cannot go around in our classroom accusing people of doing things without having two or three other classmates there who saw this offense happen and who can back you up before you come tattle to the teacher. So this is what they call it now, budging. They don't call it cutting anymore. They call it budging in line. So you cannot come tell me that Amelia budged you, right, without at least two other people seeing Amelia actually budge you. And budging is probably the most serious offense in kindergarten. But Moses' point, right, is that you have to have witnesses to crimes and offenses. And maybe now that I'm thinking about it, we need this two-witness rule in kindergarten because tattling can get out of hand really, really quickly. Now, I scribbled this note in my Bible sometime after the Willow Creek story became public in 2018. And I found it again to myself this past summer when I was reading the book of Deuteronomy again outside in my backyard. And I snapped a photo of what I wrote months ago, and you can read what it says, "No witness, she is believed." And I learned about this passage from my dad when he responded in a blog post to Willow Creek's pastors and elders back in 2018. And he taught me that these verses in Deuteronomy are the verses that Willow should have been considering as its biblical precedent. This here is as close as the Bible gets, he said, to an accuser versus a pastor. She is believed. And here again, my dad taught me that in the very part of the law where Moses is explaining that witnesses are needed when you accuse someone of a crime, here we find an exception, an example of when a witness is not needed, when a woman is victimized by a man. So I wrote this note to myself next to Deuteronomy 22, and I won't read the whole text, but basically what it says is that a woman was victimized by a man. There was nobody to rescue her, no witness. But the man, according to Moses, should be held accountable for what he did. She should be believed. And now I understand that we have to use discernment in these cases. I know there's exceptions. I know we have to apply wisdom. But I have come to feel so deeply about this passage since I learned of it years ago. It has become one of my favorites in the entire Bible because I think it reveals so beautifully who God is and how he comforts people in distress. And out there in my backyard, I realized for myself, maybe for the first time, that of course this is who God is. Of course this is what he would do for a victimized human. He would offer relief to a woman who is abused and powerless and ashamed. And he would hold accountable the one who misused his power. That's who God is. And this passage is one of the reasons why I am standing here today, and my kindergartners are with a substitute teacher, why I'm an accidental author, and it's one of the reasons I got involved in advocacy for those who are victimized and then wounded further as they resisted and told the truth. It's because who God is. Like he revealed himself here and in this passage and so many more. Now, here's another reason, and I see some Willow Creek faces. If you have been harmed by Willow, you might want to look away. I'm going to put something on the screen that might be a trigger for you. It started with this article in the Chicago Tribune. This is March 23, 2018. And this article, we now understand, was the tip of the iceberg. I read in this article, I listened to statements, I heard Willow Creek call women, some of them friends of our family who we knew would be truthful, they were being called liars publicly. But it was really confusing and disorienting for Mark, my husband, and me at the time in those early months because we wanted to believe our church, Willow Creek. But we also recognize the reality here that only one side, the church or the women, could be telling the truth. And then I listened as people, my friends, believed Willow's elders and pastors, and they turned their anger towards the actual victims and the whistleblowers instead of the church. And I will tell you what it felt like. It felt like we were watching a toxic culture ruin its Christian witness for a time. So my dad listened and he read and watched all this too, and he would teach Mark and me things like that Deuteronomy precedent that I shared earlier. And I really pestered him to write. I did not want to be the one to do the writing. And I wanted him to use his platform to hold Willow accountable, and I felt like it's time. We need to hear from a respected authority and theologian on the Bible. Using the Bible to silence people felt totally unacceptable to me. And eventually we wrote together, and that became the book, A Church Called Tov. That book all started with the false narratives that we saw come out of Willow Creek. Now, thinking back to who the Bible reveals God is and those words that I scribbled in my Bible next to Deuteronomy, no witness, she is believed. What we saw from Willow Creek and so many other churches, we know it's much bigger than Willow Creek, that's not at all who God is. God is truth. He is Tov. And I won't spend too much time on the word Tov this morning. If you were here last year, you heard all about that. But you should know it is a three-letter word. It is a Hebrew word. It's a beautiful little word that means goodness. And I have learned that it is found hundreds of times in the Old Testament. And that's how I became an accidental author and advocate. So in the years after Tov released and people had time to read it and absorb it, they would often ask my dad and me, well, how can we transform our church? How can we take it from toxic to Tov? And this is a big question, especially someone for me. I'm trained as an educator. It still is a big question for me, to be honest, and I was not initially comfortable speaking into that topic. But this question, how do we transform a toxic culture? It did not go away and became even more frequent as months went on, and so did several others. People would ask us, how can we initiate change in our church? How do we form a goodness culture? What red flags should we look for? So we started to read widely. We talked to many women and men who had actually transformed their organization. And through all of these, we ended up developing a vision for transformation, and that ended up becoming the book Pivot. And before I get any further, by pivot, we don't mean, like my dad says when he's talking to pastors, it doesn't mean like something surface level, like changing a service time or adding a ministry, or if you're a teacher like me, adding a new curriculum and thinking your kids, your students are going to be more kind and patient. Not going to happen, right? Those are just surface level changes, but they don't actually transform cultures or people. By pivot, we mean pervasive, deep culture transformation. And what I've learned is that we can do this. We can participate together in transforming cultures from toxic to Tov. And I know this because I have seen it personally happen, and I've read about it, and I have heard about beautiful stories of transformation in the last few years, and I'm going to tell you about one of those in a moment. But first, I want to tell you briefly what our vision for transformation looks like. It literally looks like a peach tree. Now, we picked this because I have one in my backyard, a peach tree. Mark and I planted it years ago when we moved into our home, and we found it perfect for this illustration because, by all appearances, it is extremely unhealthy. It never grows peaches. In 10 years, we've literally never eaten one peach off of this tree. It gets fungus every spring. It's not good. So you think of a peach tree. You've got soil, trunk, branches, leaves. Hopefully you get juicy, tasty peaches. And the fruit, the peaches, are the symbol that we chose to represent what people visibly see and experience in your culture. Now, I'm familiar with the Anglican tradition, so the peaches of the Anglican church would be like the greeters at the door. It would be the robes that the pastors wear, and there's different colors to symbolize the church calendar. There's the architecture is very peaceful and calming. Music, liturgy, rituals are like rooted in ancient tradition and culture. They pass the weekly peace. So it's like what people see and what they experience when they walk in the doors and enter your culture. And when they leave, they can maybe identify what they saw and felt and experienced. So those are your peaches. And now those peaches, healthy as they might seem, are fed and grown by what is underneath the soil, what you cannot see, the invisible elements of your culture. Now, I'm using a metaphor here of a peach tree, but this is research-based, that the invisible elements of your culture feed what is visible. Now, our backyard peaches stop growing when they are about the size of a golf ball, and they never green, and they never ripen. And so what I have learned is that we have to treat the soil of our tree. We have to use compost. We have to care for it better. The problem is not our peaches or the fungus or the dead branches or the squirrels that come eat them. Those are visible problems, but the real problem is the health of our tree. And that starts with the soil, most of which we cannot see because it's all underground. So some cultures are healthy and tove, and we thank God for that. But in toxic cultures, what we have learned is that the soil is contaminated. It's contaminated by you name it because you have seen it, right? Ambition, pride, power abuse, greed. These are toxic. They pollute the tree. They pollute the entire culture because the soil is neglected. So if your church's or organization's soil is polluted, you might still get some really lovely peaches, like a beautiful Sunday service, but you're also getting toxic fruit in places too. Like maybe, for example, in the office, behind closed doors, power abuse is happening, and employees are being mistreated. Most people can't see it. Most people don't even know it's there, but somebody knows it's there. Even if the majority don't, the victim certainly knows it's there. And eventually, and you can count on this, in some way, the toxicity, if it is ignored or not corrected, it will leak and it will contaminate the culture. So to be healthy, you have to treat the soil, add nutrients, care for it, and maybe even replace some of it altogether. So what we have learned, what needs to go into the soil of your culture, is what is tov, like the fruits of the Spirit, love, kindness, grace. So that's a huge nutshell summary of our peach tree vision for transformation. And maybe you're still thinking, okay, well, how do I do that? How do I actually care for the soil? How do I transform it? And I think the best way for me to answer that is just by telling the story of two pastors who actually did this. They transformed a culture that had become toxic in many ways, and they started with the soil. So early in the writing process for Pivot, this book arrived on my doorstep from my dad. He said, "Read this and write about it for Pivot." I had never heard of it. Renovation of the Church. It's by then pastors Mike Lucan and Kent Carlson. And they tell the story of transforming their church. It's called Oak Hills, Folsom, California. And they transformed it from an attractional model to a spiritual formation model. And they did this again because some of the attractional celebrity model culture had become toxic. So shortly after they founded their church, they came out here into Chicago to a Willow Creek conference, and they ended up adopting its attractional model. And it was very successful. Their attendance exploded. They became a mega church. They called the growth exhilarating and intoxicating, and they said, "We really liked the attention," these are the pastors, "of becoming up-and-coming leaders. We were well-known by Willow Creek." They offer, by the way, no criticism of Willow Creek. They said, "Everything we tried from Willow worked." But they started to feel increasingly uneasy. They mentioned things like their runaway ambition. They described their services like they were feeding a monster. They said they would put on weekend services and then realize the congregation, which had ultimately become consumers. And I offer no judgment because I was one of those consumers long ago, not too long ago. They wanted an even better performance for the next weekend. So what was feeding their soil was attraction and consumerism and numbers and ambition. So the disruption, the unease came when they started reading Dallas Willard, Eugene Peterson, and more, and they paid attention to the stirring of the Spirit in their soul. And here is what ultimately led to the transformation process. They said, "We found ourselves in an almost constant state of disequilibrium. We began to realize that our current church structure was actually working against the invitation of Christ to experience his transformation." So they decided to pivot. They had to care for the soil. They pivoted. They no longer counted how many people were coming. Instead, they focused on who those people were becoming. They had to disciple the congregation instead of allow them to sit and consume a show every Sunday and then go home until the next weekend and then return for another show, and they expected it to be just as good or even better. And the pastors steadily pushed against it. They pushed against the consumerism. They discipled their congregation. And I think this story illustrates every part of culture transformation that I described with the peach tree metaphor. The transformation started with the soil. They listened to the Spirit. They surrendered to him, and they began the process of removing consumerism from their soil. They removed greed. They removed competition and ambition. They completely removed success as a goal and counting how many people were coming. But they added to the soil too. They added discipleship. And they got up from the pulpit and taught people how to live like Jesus. They intentionally cultivated the soil. The pastors surrendered to the Spirit, followed him, and then let God do the work of transformation in their lives and in the culture of the church. Now, speaking of transformation, I'm going to end here on a very personal note. 2 summers ago, I entered what became the hardest season of my life to date. And although I'm not quite ready to talk about those details publicly, I will tell you that trauma forced me into the office of a therapist who is also a spiritual director. He's also seminary trained. I was in really good hands. He's still my therapist. And somewhere deep, months into my journey of grief, he looked at me and he said, "Laura, do not waste your suffering." And I said, "What do you even mean?" He taught me that God is always at work to redeem pain. And he told me to use my suffering to grow closer to God. And he told me how to do this. He said, "Tell God about your deepest pain. Tell him what you're feeling and thinking like he doesn't know. And then let him sit with you in it." And because I was on summer break at the time, I did what my therapist told me to do. I went outside under the trees, sat in a chair, usually with one of my beagles, every day. I wrote, I journaled, I talked to God, I cried. I could spend hours doing this every day. And days, weeks, months passed. And as I slowly came out of the fog of trauma, I could look back and actually see visible signs of being healed. And I realized that I was not the same. I felt redeemed, I felt revived, and dare I say, I felt transformed. And I can almost thank God now a little bit for the suffering, because I think without it, the transformation would not have happened. And I'm sharing this story because I want you to know that I did not do this transformational work on myself. Oftentimes, trauma and disruption, they lead to change for sure. And maybe I agreed to finally surrender. But I did not transform myself. God did. He did the deep work of healing and transformation. It was grace. And the same can be said of what he did in the culture at Oak Hills Church too. They sensed disruption and they agreed to surrender. And one day I looked up and I realized that here I am helping my dad write Pivot, a literal book about transformation, and I realized God was doing his own transformative work in me. And I suddenly and very personally understood for the first time the deep truths of grace, because I was actively living what we were writing, that it is God's work, and it is by his grace, and it is a gift that I could not have imagined. And I think it is the same transformative work from God that we want to see in our cultures too. We have to surrender to the Spirit like Oak Hills did. We have to listen to what the Spirit wants added to our soil and what he wants removed. We can all learn more about God and who he is from our suffering and pain and trauma in our personal lives and in our cultures too. And the last thing I will say is this: if we want to transform our lives and our cultures, it's not going to happen because of willpower or by hiring talented people or educated people or very charismatic people. It is not going to happen by adding a ministry or changing a service time or buying a new curriculum like we teachers do. The deep, deep transformational work from where we are to where we want to be, from where our culture is to where we want our culture to be, that is the work of God. He does the transforming. And my hope is that we will all respond to God's invitations in our disruptions, in our stirrings of the Spirit, and in our suffering. It is by his grace, and it is where deepest transformation often begins. Amen. Thank you.
Well, I so appreciate how Laura ended her message, and it's so true that we're incapable of change apart from the transformative work of the Holy Spirit. And though these talks from Restore are filled with incredible wisdom, wisdom alone can only do so much. It's God who works in us to will and to act according to his tov, or good purpose. Well, again, that message was from our last Restore conference, and we would love to see you at our next Restore, February 7th and 8th in Phoenix, Arizona. And for more information and to hear about an upcoming special offer for Restore, just go to restore2025.com. Again, that's restore2025.com. Also, if you appreciate this ministry, would you please help us continue this work by donating to the Roys Report? As I've said before, we don't have advertisers or many big donors. We simply have you, the people who care about exposing abuse and corruption and restoring the Bride of Christ to what she was meant to be. So to give, just go to julieroys.com/donate. That's julieroys.com/donate. Also, just a quick reminder to subscribe to The Roys Report on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. That way you won't miss any of these episodes. And while you're at it, I'd really appreciate it if you'd help us spread the word about the podcast by leaving a review. And then please share the podcast on social media so more people can hear about this great content. Again, thanks for joining me today. Hope you were blessed and encouraged.